ultimately, an individual artist's definition of fulfillment is utterly personal. Hi everyone, my name is Dinuk Wijayaratne. Welcome, Happy New Year. I'm a composer, conductor, and pianist, an improviser to be exact. I'm also a consultant on issues of creativity, and I'm here with my dear colleague, Nick Halley.
Hello, everyone. I am a drummer and a choir director and a big fan of Dinuk's, so I'm excited to be invited to be on this podcast with him.
Oh, well, I'm a very big fan of Nick's, and we put out a call for the burning questions of young musicians, and you were very generous in your responses, so we're going to dive right in to a question here. And this is from a young musician who is a fantastic string player, but also a composer in genres outside the classical music industry. And he asks, was it ever difficult to advocate for your creative dreams and goals rather than pursuing a slightly more traditional career path? Were there people along the way who did not understand your choices? And how did you deal with that? Nick, please jump in. No time to think.
Well, it's an excellent question. Obviously, I mean, the use of the term traditional interests me strangely.
Absolutely, me too.
Yeah, in that I think maybe Dinuk, you and I are somewhat similar in a shared love of certain traditions. They may not be the same traditions even, but we both love particular traditions. But I think the question is a good one, because we tend as artists, as musicians, to think that if we just do things correctly within a tradition, that the tradition will recognize us. And of course, that's not the case, because we recognize the greats of any tradition after the fact. And I have a bit of an anecdote, Dinuk, kind of a story here that, so please jump in if I'm taking too much time.
No. This is the forum for anecdotes, I should add. I'm ready. Nick.
That's lucky. Because the question brings up for me a particular story. And for you, the listener, you should know that Dinuk did ask me about this. And I told him, at some point he asked me about this, about how I ended up playing with James Taylor, who's a sort of American icon of singer-songwriter, kind of the OG of singer-songwriters in the States. And that was a very circuitous route. You know, people say, oh, I came to this by a circuitous route. I mean, there's only one route to get to where I am in my life, and it's circuitous. And in what happened to me, the part of the question that I want to address is when he says, he or she says, did you ever have to advocate for the path you were choosing or something against perhaps other voices? And I have a distinct memory of when I moved to Nova Scotia from the States. This is 12 years ago. And I was leaving my connection to New York City, to the people with whom I had most of my gigs as a drummer and as a hand percussionist. And a couple of my friends sort of fell into two camps. Because I was coming to Nova Scotia to get into choral music more deeply, work with my dad, who's a great choral conductor and composer and improviser and organist and pianist, and therefore kind of take a left from the jazz world percussion route track that I might have appeared to be on. Because of that, my friends kind of fell into two categories. One was in complete support of that endeavor, right? Oh, well, you've got stuff to steal from your very own dad. I mean, go and get it, right? The other were saying, you're going to disappear. And I have a distinct memory of a great musical friend of mine that I have always admired telling me, you're going to go there and you're going to disappear. And of course, what he meant was my drumming career, such as it was, could fall awfully quiet. And so then fast forward, say 5 years, I've been living in Nova Scotia for these 5 years, building a couple of choirs, just working my buns off to try to improve my chops in choral conducting and keyboard playing and all this sort of stuff. And also playing the drums and trying. And luckily at that point, I think I was playing with you, D-Nook. And so I had some great musical challenges in my life to keep my drum chops up. But I was back down in the States helping my brother-in-law with a music camp. And I'm delivering some instruments to the camp for my brother-in-law. And I'm getting out of the van and I hear this voice behind me, getting out of a car that's pulled up behind me. And it says, Nick Halley. And I thought, oh no, this is some parent that's going to harass me now about, you know, whether the little Johnny has his swimming shorts or something. But I was kind of going to hide. I was going to just keep cruising. And then I thought, there's something in that voice that I recognize. So sure enough, I turn around and there's all 6'7" of James Taylor standing there saying, is that you, Nick Halley? And he had heard about me from my brother-in-law, and I think from maybe someone else, other people. My brother-in-law is a great musician in that area. And he had heard about this guy who was a drummer, but also a choir director. And his interest in me was sparked because he had a gig coming up with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So he wanted to chat with me about that. So he just said, would you come over to my house and maybe we could talk about this gig, figure out what songs would work best and all this sort of thing. And I said, absolutely, I'm up for that. Because when I was about 12, I saw James Taylor live at Tanglewood. And I thought to myself, if I'm ever cursed with the gig with a superstar, that's the one I want. And I was correct, because in my admittedly somewhat limited experience, but not altogether limited experience of stars and working with them, I was right. My instincts were right. James Taylor is the best in my mind person to work with, and absolutely great musician and a great human being. So at the time when I said, absolutely, I'll come over and talk about this gig with you. He said, great, could you bring some instruments? Like maybe we'll want to play a little bit. So I did, and we went, and it was just a feast of reason and flow of soul. You know, we went down to the bar, we talked about the gig, we talked about what songs of his would work that I knew of, and he would play me stuff. But then we went down to the barn to just jam a little bit, and I pulled out my instruments and we jammed, and it was kind of love at first sight. I mean, I don't mean that lightly. I was quite thrilled by his response to my playing, because his response came, and this is the part that I think is very important for young artists to always remember. His response to my playing came from a purely musical, person to person, musical soul to musical soul place, right? There was no pedigree. I did not have to display any paperwork. I had none to display. That was not where our connection was resonating.
Yes, so, it was just based on your playing in the moment and that human connection, right?
Exactly. And strangely, I think what he responded to in my playing was the same thing that you evidently respond to. And it really comes from this mutt-like quality of my musical training and musical experience that I've always thought there was something wrong with my lack of focus on one particular track. And that, but what that experience among many, many in my life have pointed, just keep turning me around and showing me that actually you're wrong about that. It is precisely that synthesis of different elements that makes you who you are. It makes you unique in the landscape, whether you like it or not, you know, whether I like my own playing or not. It's all of that mixture of stuff that makes me someone that James Taylor likes and that Dinuk Widjuratne likes to play with and so on. And the singing and the choral directing and the attempt to play the pipe organ have a profound effect on my drumming. And that's completely seemingly beyond my control. I didn't will that to be the case. It just is. So I hope that that's somewhat helpful, because that for me was the beginning of many years playing with James Taylor. And I still do. Hopefully when the pandemic calms down, I'll get to play with him again. But just as an indication of precisely not the route to get the gig with James Taylor, right? I moved away from the very state in
from
which
the epicenter.
He lives.
Yes.
Yeah, and I moved to Nova Scotia to become this obscure choir director who starts choirs for men and boys and archaic stuff like that. And the next thing I know, I get hired by James Taylor. So odd, but...
Odd indeed. But I think, you know, to bring it back to our friend's question, it's important to summarize a couple of really fascinating things about your story. One is this, the circuitous nature of the route, as you said, right? So, you know, you were in the, shall we say, so-called epicenter of things, where certain forces had defined that as the quote unquote traditional path.
Right.
Or the path of least resistance or the most direct path.
Right.
And so the lesson here is, you know, if you just follow your heart, you end up in unexpected places and you defy some of these things, right? Because it's one can never predict how these things go. That's one thing. And the second thing is this notion of synthesis and how, you know, because you're you know, when I play with you, I sense that he is a very honest and open and authentic individual, right? So you're following your instincts. You know, you leave to go to another city because you are following some kind of artistic instinct. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that you end up in this coveted position of playing for a great musician.
Right.
Because there has been this synthesis.
Right.
Of very, very disparate things.
Right.
You know.
And that's why it can start, I think for the young musician, it can start to feel like some people are lucky and some aren't. And the reason that we can fall into that trap is that there are so many drummers out there who you could go on YouTube and find them playing note for note. And very well, an excellent version of any one of James Taylor's songs, where they're playing every note Steve Gadd played, or every note that any one of the drummers that played with James on the various recordings. You would think that would be the track, would be to really focus on getting a hold of that gig. The problem is that now you have found yourself in an element of scarcity, because there's only that one gig and there are 1,000 of you and trying to get it. And so, and this is very challenging. I mean, for classical musicians, they've been through this forever, right? So I just wanted to mention that so it would appear that it's sheer luck that I get to do that gig. And I'm not discounting the power of serendipity. However, what you're suggesting is that by following my sort of instincts, as you're saying, I courted that luck. I didn't know that at the time, and I never have. I think that so much of what happens to us that is remarkable in our artistic lives and careers happens when we're looking the other way. And but that's very important to be aware of that in the way that we think and plan, because all we can do, we do have some agency over our own baseline improvement, right? As we practice, as we think about our craft, as we hone it, we do have some agency over that. And I think that we can fall into a trap in which we think we have a lot of agency over our career. And my advice is always just stay the course, just keep going. You know, it's okay to slow down, but it's not okay to stop, but just keep going. Because when in that stage, that transition to Nova Scotia from the States was not an easy one. I wouldn't try to make that claim.
It reminds me of a few quotes, actually. I'm not sure where they're all from, but one is that, you know, life happens to you while you're busy making your plans, right? And the second thing is that luck can be seen as the marriage of opportunity and great preparation.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I should give a shout out to an incredible person who sadly left us this year, Sir Ken Robinson, who I think still has the most watched TED Talk, and he's the famous education guru that everyone loves to hear speak. You know, I was actually blessed to hear him speak live. Mm. One of the things he said that I've never forgotten is that he says, you know, educational systems evolve to present a view of learning and life as a very linear path. But right. That is not the case. It's actually a highly haphazard, organic, circuitous path. Mm. If you ask anyone who has any kind of career or artistic fulfillment, they'll describe some kind of, you know, very haphazard path.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of our systems are presenting this path to us as some perfectly straight line. You know, I remember when I was in high school, I was in a British school in Dubai in the Middle East, and you had to get, you know, really good GCSEs to get to get your A levels of choice. And in order to get into the university of choice, you had to get the, you know, exactly the right A levels and that kind of thing, you know, so everything is presented as this kind of linear thing. And then when I became a musician, the tradition.
That's the problem. The problem is you became a musician.
If only someone had told me.
If someone had told you, Dina, you just need to be an engineer.
I know.
Because the system hopefully would have served you well.
Yes, I'd be set and completely fulfilled.
Talking to me right now.
Yeah, I mean, and so I guess this is a good segue into my story, which is that I was nuts about composition ever since I was 12. So I did an undergrad and a grad degree in composition. And while this was happening, I realized I was very passionate about conducting, okay? Among other things, among, you know, improvisation. And so I made the decision to stay in New York for an extra 2 years and take another degree in conducting. So I did that. And apparently I was the first person in the history of college, in the college to win a conducting job before I left. So I actually got the job as assistant conductor with Symphony Nova Scotia before I had even completed my degree. And anyway, everyone was thrilled. My teacher was thrilled. And
just so that we all know, which college are you talking about?
Manus College.
Manus.
Yeah, I did the conducting degree at Manus.
Okay.
And I remember at my farewell party in New York City that my friends threw for me, you know, everyone was hugging me and wishing me and congratulating me. And they were saying things to me like, oh, you're set for life. And these were musicians, right?
Mm.
So of course it pumps you up, and then you move to another province and you just dive into this job that is just full on. You know, I was studying scores, you know, I was just coming home from one rehearsal, just having a quick bite and then picking up the next score, right? And so it was just nonstop. And And just to say that this story has ended extremely well, because Symphony Nova Scotia, as you know, is like my musical family, right? Like, I know the musicians, I know their kids. It's an amazing feeling for a conductor when you know an orchestra like family and you have a relationship of, say, 15 years with them. They play all my pieces, I've guest conducted. For our viewers there, our Zoom connection just froze momentarily, so I'm gonna jump back into the story. So I arrived in Nova Scotia and I start this very, very busy job with a fantastic orchestra. And over 3 years, I amassed incredible experience that has really held me in good stead. So like I say, I still have a great relationship with them. I guest conduct several times a year. I'm going there in March now. But after about the 2 year mark, there was this kind of, I'll just describe it as a kind of malaise, personal malaise that set in for me, right? I was still doing the job, enjoying these experiences, but I felt something was off. And I just couldn't put my finger on it. I did not have the tools. No one in my music education had prepared me with the tools to diagnose what was happening.
Right.
And I did a lot of, shall we say, self-help work in the summer. I read lots of books about psychology and creativity, and I did these exercises, which I still recommend to people today. And one of these exercises was this kind of vision exercise where you try to pinpoint the values that are important to you as an artist, as a musician, as a human. And it's actually, it's very easy. It looks very easy, this exercise on paper, but it took me several weeks.
It sounds terribly difficult to me.
I mean, it's just, like I said, it looks easy. If someone says, what two personal values or qualities do you consider most important? I mean, it's very easy to list 10 or 15.
Right.
When you whittle it down to the top two,
right,
that's when it gets very interesting, because then you have to choose one over the other.
Right.
Right. So for instance, as an improviser, do you value consistency over spontaneity? It's that kind of thing, right? I'm not saying that one is better than the other, right? Anyway, so I go through this exercise and suddenly I see at the top of this list, the word creativity. And I remember distinctly this feeling like I had, there was this epiphany. It was like a physical feeling almost. And I just went, oh man, I am not enjoying enough creativity in the art and science of conducting, frankly.
Right.
That was my big epiphany, right? And I'm happy to debate this with conductors, but I will say that if you spend most of your time as a composer, I mean, of course, I'm creating notes from scratch versus interpreting a text.
Sure.
Okay. There is, of course, a massively different creative margin. But anyway, long story short, for me as an individual, this indicated that I needed much more composition in my life. I needed to get back to composing. I needed a lifestyle as a creator of music and not so much as someone who is interpreting music.
Right.
So after the job finished, I made a, for me at the time, a very, I think, scary, terrifying, courageous decision to go freelance. I still had some conducting. I was with the Nova Scotia Youth Orchestra, but it was just the right size. I only did about 5 or 6 programs a year. And I devoted all the rest of the time to creating music, essentially. And to circle back to our friend's question, like I said, I didn't have any guidance, and then going back to all of my dear friends in New York who I'm still in touch with, they might have had a certain perception of the conducting industry,
right?
Which is probably true. Like if someone purely wanted to conduct, they would have been on the fast track. They would be where they were, where they wanted to be, right? But I think the moral of the story is no one knows ultimately what you want as an individual.
Exactly.
And at the time, I didn't know what I wanted as an individual. until I went through some kind of value system analysis and really figured out what was important. And you see, and as soon as I saw the word creativity there, I started to look for it in my various musical activities.
You know, Dinuk, what you're saying just makes me think of one thing. I used to, because I work in the nonprofit world so much, I used to kind of see the grass as greener in for-profit, where things are simpler, more efficient. And one time I was at some kind of a event and I was talking to some high-level businessman who said, he said, so you work in for-profit, you're probably working in nonprofit as a choir director and musician and stuff. And I said, yeah, in general, if I'm in a meeting, it's a nonprofit event. And he said, see, that's so interesting. Endless. We in business can always learn from the nonprofit world because you have two bottom lines. He said, in business, we have one bottom line, which it's how are the dollars and cents adding up? And in your business, there are two. There's the mission statement that you have to pay attention to. So is the organization fulfilling its mission as well as meeting the bottom line requirements? And, you know, I think it is helpful. I think as musicians, I think we do have to just recognize that as a reality, as a fact, because even if I get the coveted job that I thought I was striving toward when I went to Juilliard and I got my undergrad, and then I went to Manus and I got my master's, and then I went to yet another school and got my doctorate. And then I turned down the teaching job because I got a job at the New York Philharmonic where I'm making six figures to play music. And then 10 years later, I discover that I'm relatively unhappy, or that there's some part of my life like this epiphany. I love that you had to have an epiphany to realize that you're a creative person whose juices weren't being used enough. But it can happen to all manner of things can happen to an individual creative person in all fields. It's not just music or the arts. And I think it's good. It's simply to maintain that sense of a realistic point of view about that. And that's where this idea that if you just get on this track and your friends in their kindness were congratulating you on having gotten further down the track. So if you just follow this track and you do well and you work hard, you will be fulfilled. That might be true as long as all you're looking for is a little increase to your paycheck every year. But if you're looking for something else, then that's a red herring that is sold by academic institutions. I love academic institutions, but that is the danger that I see coming out for students coming out of an institutional education.
Yeah, and this is a perfect time to examine that word tradition, because it's worth analyzing why these patterns evolve, right? You know, if we're both classical musicians, we're both improvisers too, we work in other genres, but we're both classically trained, right? The Western classical tradition is a glorious richness of creativity, right? And in a sense, you know, when you stand, when you're a creator in this tradition, you feel the weight of everything that's come before you. You have a incredible opportunity to tap into all of this, right? But it's worth noting that this dichotomy of tradition and innovation is a very, very complex one. And it has to be seen as a paradox, as the paradox that it is. Right, mm-hmm. Because otherwise we are in danger of looking at all of our favorite pieces, all of our favorite classical concerts of the past, as things that were sealed hermetically in some kind of, you know, museum bubble, if you will. We risk also seeing them as fixed points. When I'm always saying to people, they were not fixed points; they were in motion. Mm-hmm. Right, everything is in motion. Mm-hmm. Everyone who has innovated in classical music has been reacting to their environment. Bach, you could see Bach as a fixed point just because he's such a sort of institution in himself.
Right.
But he was, you know, his music was an amalgam, a very, very sophisticated amalgam of Italian, French, German, all these Baroque styles, right? So he was not a fixed point. He was in motion, you know. Everyone, all of us, we are currently in motion in a tradition that has certain norms. Of course, this is not an easy balance, but it should be seen as the paradox that it is. Like, in order to survive well and continue to innovate, because mm-hmm. we all need to innovate to keep the tradition going, you have to see yourself as in motion. You have to be authentic, and you have to be willing to challenge this tradition in a very, very healthy way. And I think when systems get bigger and bigger, they just, you know, by their very nature, they tend to sort of, as they're looking for patterns, and the human brain is always trying to look for patterns, it tends to kind of make those patterns a bit more rigid. And I'm not saying this with any disrespect to any of my colleagues, the orchestras I've worked with, any of the institutions I've worked with, but just to say that ultimately, and individual artist's definition of fulfillment is utterly personal.
Mm-hmm. You know? That's right.
So we can throw all the assumptions at it that we want to, but ultimately the answer about what that fulfillment is should come from the individual. And we need to have systems in place that help those people discover what that sense of fulfillment is about. You know,
it's funny, Dinok, because as you're speaking, it seems like it would appear that we're living at a time in which individualism is so rampant that this would not be an issue. When we look, but what you're saying is true. When we look at an orchestra, every one of those people has some sense of their own fulfillment as a musician, at which they are constantly balancing in their lives, just as I am, just as you are, just as the most famous conductor in the world is. So, but we're living at a time when, and I wonder if this is because of the 20th century, where the sort of individual response to the system was to say, well, we need to blow this all up. So I now have to, not only do I have to reject the tradition, I have to annihilate it.
Yeah.
And come up with my own language, because it's all about me and what I'm producing. And I think that's a bit confusing for people. It certainly was for me, because that's not taking into account the fact that the music that moves me, that has moved me, and that has kept me alive, was written by other people, who, someone like Bach, who we associate with a tradition. But what you're saying is, simply because that person comes from, now we ascribe their greatness, and we sort of graft it on to that tradition. That's very real and true. And there's always something to be learned from that tradition, and therefore that individual. But that they are not a fossil, as you were saying. And so that's not how they necessarily experienced their life or their creative process. Is that making some sense to what you're saying?
Yes, and do you mean in the sense of this individual being very, very unique, in the sense that they exist at the intersection of all of their influences?
That's right.
You know, just yeah. as you know, just as you being a very, very, you know, when I hear you play percussion and I hear you create this sound and atmosphere, it's utterly unique, right? And I always think, you know, it's just wonderful, like, how many Bach loving world percussionists could there be? And, you know, I just mentioned two
Right.
Those influences, right? But like all these influences are coming from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be courageous enough to identify your coordinate, your highly specific coordinate that's at the middle, in the mm-hmm. middle of all of these things,
mm-hmm.
and really embrace that, and understand that by virtue of it being highly unique, you can ultimately transcend the sum of all of these influences, you know, mm-hmm. to create something unique.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, we circle back to the notion of synthesis of everything you love, mm-hmm. being authentic enough to embrace that, and being and as our friend has asked the question, yes, you have to be incredibly courageous to consider that your definition of personal fulfillment might be very different to the definition of the very well-meaning people around you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. Excellent point.
Absolutely.
I think that we've all, most of us, and probably anybody taking the time to listen to us yap about things, has probably already gone through the process of understanding that success is something that can be defined differently from that we all need to have our definition of success kind of updated regularly. And I'm sure that we've all been through experiences or seen how that's the case, seen how our idea of success might be actually slightly different from somebody we know and even somebody we respect and admire. And but I think it bears repeating that what you're saying.
Absolutely. And to bring it back to the amazing Ken Robinson again, you know, in his book, The Element, he coins this phrase. Actually, well, I don't know if he coined the phrase, but he talks about what he calls circles of constraint, right? And he's talking about social circles of constraint, which come from various, these are social circles like peer groups, family, industry, workplace, academic institutions, which these circles may constrain you by their perspectives or definitions of things, right? And he also says they are doing this with the best of intentions, usually, mm-hmm. because they want something for you. I mean, you know, if you grow up in an Asian country, there's this kind of cliche that everyone wants you to become either a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer or something, or, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I remember just feeling like an outlier when
or the world's next concert pianist or superstar violinist.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be family, it could be peer groups. They might have a perspective that is ultimately not yours. And he's talking about how, you know, he says the word constraint, because this could, it could constrain you in terms of your choices. And if you're a sensitive person, you might second guess your career path or your artistic choices. And it only takes a misplaced comment or sometimes even a raised eyebrow. I remember when I auditioned at Juilliard, you know, you have to audition with each of the composition faculty in turn. Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting when you get five radically different responses to your own work right. or your own goals.
Right.
And I remember my teacher, John Corigliano, you know, we got off, you know, he knew my work. So I ended up studying with him. But when I interviewed with someone else and I mentioned just on the side that I was passionate about learning how to improvise, and I was learning, you know, a lot of jazz language at the time, mm-hmm. I got a smirk and a raised eyebrow, right? and presumably this person thought that it would either be a distraction from the business at hand,
yeah.
or perhaps that he thought that it was a really bad decision artistically. I don't know, you know. It didn't turn into a discussion, but this is all to say that if you're I've always been a quietly stubborn person, right?
Mm.
I present in this very polite way, I guess, but I've just, I'll take the eyebrow and then I'll just go off and just do whatever the hell I want, you know. But I think, you know, for someone, for an impressionable youngster who's very sensitive, that raised eyebrow at a crucial moment might put you off.
Yes.
Pursuing a goal.
Yep. Auditions are very important that way. And that's why I luckily I don't have to do auditions in my life right now, but I do have to run them where I'm auditioning other people for choirs and things. And I do try to tell people, let people know that, whereas I don't think that I'm a nasty auditioner, they're certainly out there. And
I don't know. I've heard some stories. No, I'm kidding.
Not true, Dee. Yeah. But the experience, a nasty audition experience, might be very good for you if you can learn from it and you can realize, perhaps I was rejected because that's not where I belong, and that could be a very helpful experience, but obviously very dangerous too, because it can be so hard on people. But I think the audition process, auditioning for anything, is very dangerous, and therefore possibly valuable if you can glean from it what you will.
Yeah. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that we reject all of this advice, because the thing is, you know, I thrive on advice from people we trust. And I'm not saying that we become, you know, autonomous, completely autonomous anarchists, right, in our pursuit of, you know, artistic fulfillment. But that's why this is so tricky. You have to balance the advice you listen to and the advice you take from, ultimately, I think what's most important, which is a new rubric of a personal definition of fulfillment. And that's how you define what your artistic goals are. You first have to define for yourself what fulfillment is going to be.
And, you know, I used to play with a Slovenian saxophonist who used to say, "Watch out, the jazz police might be coming tonight." Things like that. And in every genre, in every milieu of every creative activity, and I'm sure the same can be said of other fields, there's this idea of the board that's out, the adjudicating board that's out there that's going to tell everyone what you're doing is okay or what you're doing is not okay. We're going to line everybody up and take them to the station, right? And we have to play as... I don't know if Miles said this, but you got to play like the cops are outside waiting for you. So it is good to say, no, I'm doing this. I know this is right. I'm going to keep doing it. But the challenge is, as I said, we all also have this love of certain musical traditions, certain musical experiences or sounds or teachers or all these, this amazing outpouring that music just as one stream has had to offer humankind for many thousands of years. And we want to be a part of that. We want to jump into the stream and participate. And I'm thinking of this quote. I wish I could remember who said it, but she said, I think it was a great scientist, actually. She said, "Your surest refuge is in your science." And I interpreted that, I think, incorrectly at first, because I thought she was referring to sort of society at large and to knowledge, science as in knowledge. But if I take it individually, personally, I've noticed that what she says is absolutely true. So when I'm struggling with my own ideas of how I stack up in this grand tower of whatever tradition I might be thinking of in music, if I spend a little bit of time with the minutiae of some particular piece that I love, and it may be from the tradition that I know quite well, it could be from the jazz tradition, which I know reasonably well, or Brazilian, or classical, as in particularly choral music, but it may also come from India. It may come from Arabic music. There are these great traditions, and I can dig into that tradition and look at the science and look at the mode of a certain maqam and see its beauty and see the mathematical beauty of this particular element. And all of a sudden I'm free. I'm freed from my own self-assessment, my own trying to figure out what I'm doing, because and what I'm contributing. And that's what I do think traditions have to offer us. And we should never let someone's trying to steer us, or someone's pushing us in a certain direction, make us fail to notice what we can glean from these beautiful structures.
That's a beautiful sentiment. Maybe it's a good point.
Well, you know, I'm sentimental, Dina. You always accuse me of that.
There's too much sentimentality in your playing. I've always said that.
I'm trying to wean myself off of sentimentality in my playing. That's right.
Oh my gosh.
No, one thing I was going to say about that, when you were talking about this kind of amalgamation of elements that Bach did, and I love that then I get thrown into the same sentence as Bach, but that my playing is a kind of synthesis of things. As you were saying that, I was thinking about something Bill Frisell, who's a great, I don't know if you'd call him jazz guitarist, something he said, which was, I haven't done anything that other people didn't do. And I think that there's so much truth to what he's saying. I would absolutely say the same thing. I have not done anything on the drums or with my bits of hand percussion that other people, I'm just following what other people have done. But in the synthesis of that, this thing comes out, which evidently is me and my playing, take it or leave it, right?
I think it's you and your playing, but it's also this openness to embrace yourself, right? And that has to be, that is a courageous choice, because you do have to avoid certain pressures at key moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
Key moments.
Absolutely.
What a great question, and something I'll continue thinking about, certainly.
Me too.
Dinok, I wonder if we should repeat the question.
Let's do that. Was it ever difficult to advocate for your creative dreams and goals rather than pursuing a slightly more traditional career path? Were there people along the way who did not understand your choices, and how did you deal with that? Thanks for such an amazing question, and we'll get back to all the other questions in the next episode.
Thank you, Dinok.
Thank you, Nick. Take care.